So Michael has a clicker, and he clicks it every time I
It's
make a funny joke.
a dog clicker.
So he clicks it when I make a funny joke, and then I take a drink, and then he's training me to make funnier jokes, but it hasn't quite worked yet.
We'll get there. No dog gets it all at once, so I'll roll up a newspaper and send it through the mail to hit you later if I slap you on the nose.
With instructions, hit self in nose with this. All right.
Well, hi, diddly ho, developerinos. I told you I was going to get a new introduction, and that is no way is that going to be it. Holy crap.
I was just going to ask,
hey, Flanders.
Is that what you're going with?
Have you ever just opened your mouth and something came out, and the minute it started, you're like, well, I can't stop it now, but boy, I don't like where it's going.
And you're worried about having B-roll. So.
That is not the way to start things off. Folks, this is the Drunken UX podcast. We are on episode number 24. This week, we're going to be talking about open source project management, and we're going to look at something we've brought up a couple times, but haven't really, I guess, explained really what it is, and that is the diaper-based project. Yeah. And so Aaron knows maybe a little bit about this.
I've heard of it.
We've got a fellow on who's going to really tell us the good dirt on it, though, and so we're going to dive into that here in just a bit. Do want to tell you folks, make sure to drop by our sponsor over at newcloud.com/drunkenux. That's nucloud.com/drunkenux. There, check out their interactive mapping platform, illustration services, things like that. You'll hear more about them later on. You know how this goes. It's all good. I am one of two fantastic hosts for this show that you come back for week in and week out. I'm Michael. Yeah, we have one other one. I mean, he's kind of a host. I think I'm training him well.
I was going to say, you have one of two fantastic hosts. What am I then? I'm your other ostensibly fantastic host, Aaron Hill. And
tell people where they can find us. Help us out here.
Check us out on Twitter and facebook.com/drunkenux, and also on instagram.com/drunkenuxpodcast.
Before I forget, I do want to give a shout out to all the folks I've been annoying on Twitter. I see every once in a while saying, hey, request we're looking for a web development podcast to listen to. And if you're here because I hollered at you and said, hey, come check us out, hi to you too. I just want to
let
you know I'm listening.
We hear you. We appreciate you. And you should also come join us on Slack at drunkenux.com/slack. Sign up.
Have an interesting conversation there once in a while about site design, project design.
The interesting conversation is the one you bring to us, and then we will snark it. We'll actually give insightful.
Snark it is how I feel about the drink I have tonight. I'm gonna have to snark it to get through it. I don't know if that means talking bad about it or just I don't know if that's a word for holding my nose and drinking it. I don't know. So it won't surprise you to know that I'm drinking scotch tonight.
Really?
Because, you know, I have a failsafe, and that's what it is. But the thing, and I've got to tell this story because it humors me. I'm drinking a dram called Bruichladdich. It's called Bruichladdich Rocks. Now, if you haven't heard of it, don't feel bad because I don't think it's been sold in about 3 years. That's how long this bottle has been sitting on my shelf. The reason it has been sitting on my shelf that long is because it is terrible. And I am tired of looking at it, and so I am going to punish myself through this show, and I'm going to drink it. Basically, what they did, Bruichladdich likes to do, I call them boutique bottlings. They're like one-off runs of different things. The guy who bought Bruichladdich recently, recently a few years back, was a wine, was that a sommelier or something? Mm-hmm. A wine connoisseur. And so he thought, hey, I'll bring some of this to whiskey. And we'll do neat, creative things with it. And sometimes he's right. The Lottie Tin, perfectly good. Not a bad drink.
Is this one literally made with rocks?
No.
Does it have
That would make it
hints
better.
Of mineral, maybe?
I think what happened is the master distiller or whatever that person's name is, he walked in one day and he opened a barrel. And he went to taste that barrel. And when he tasted it, he said, oh, no, something's wrong. And he started rolling that barrel away. And a businessman walked in and said, hey, what are you doing with that barrel? I said, well, it's not good. It's bad. We're going to get rid of this. And they said, no, we have to recover some of our costs on it. What could we do to make it drinkable? And the only answer he had was, well, tell people to put a bunch of ice in it and drink it really watered down. And that's literally, it is called Rocks because it is meant to be drank on the rocks. That is the way it was marketed. It is wow. better on the rocks. And all I can think of is, yeah, no, he was
Are
like,
sure you don't mean
no,
like,
fuck you, just like water
thrown
it.
Thrown onto the rocks, like just hurl the bottle at.
It leaves me feeling like I am sucking on a mouthful of pennies.
They should have called it pennies then, or it's that metallic taste.
It has been a running joke. If you come to my house and you say you like scotch, I make you have a glass of this, and I don't tell you what it is. And it has been universally hated. I've had it for 3 years because I have not been able to give it away.
Oh.
That's how bad it is. So I'm drinking it. That's my story. I hope you enjoyed it. Aaron, take us home. What do you got?
I have something I think you would approve of. It is the Balvenie 12 Double Wood. And
yeah,
it is.
That's the sherry and whiskey aged. Yeah.
It is quite good. I recognize the name Balvenie from just some snifters I've picked up at the bars, and it's good.
It's a good start.
Pleasantly surprised. Yeah.
We'll get you into something.
Oh yeah.
The 14 Caribbean cask.
I will look for that next time.
That is good stuff. It's got a nice, they age it in rum casks, and it has this beautiful sort of brown sugar sweetness to it. That's fantastic.
Nice. What do you got, Sean?
So I'm also drinking a finished scotch. Actually, it's a bourbon. Angel's Envy. It's finished in port barrels.
Oh,
nice.
Yes, I like Angel's Envy.
It is delicious.
I have a bottle of that on my shelf. It is delicious.
I haven't drank a lot of bourbon. I've only recently been working on getting that part of my palate attuned. And Angel's Envy is one. Jefferson's Ocean is another one that I have come to love. Nice. Yeah, that Maker's 46. I like Maker's 46 a lot. I had a wild night on this very podcast with a bit bottle of Maker's 46.
Which night was that?
I don't remember.
You know,
not because I was drunk, but just because I don't remember like which episodes are which.
I remember when we did the episode with Greg Podanovich, and I was drinking that tequila, and I forget, it wasn't the Grand Mayan, it was a different one. But man, by the end of that episode, I remember him talking about something, and I just totally spaced out. Like I was just.
I hate to tell you this, but that has nothing to do with the drinking.
Oh,
so let's jump in here real fast and let's talk about. I saw a video, and this video goes back. It was maybe a month and a half ago. I think it came out. Aaron, you play some video games, don't you?
Cool.
You're kind of a gamer,
guy. Yeah.
Do you know who Markiplier is?
I know of him, and I could recognize his face if you showed it to me.
Yes. He has a fantastic radio voice. You want to talk about somebody I'd love to have on the podcast? That dude has a voice of gold.
He really does.
For folks who don't know, Markiplier is an online game streamer. He came to prominence playing horror games on YouTube years ago. Huge, like, philanthropical type of dude, and one of, like, the top subscribe channels on YouTube at this point.
Wow.
He put out a video about a month and a half ago that I caught and I thought was very interesting. Once in a while, he does this thing where he does like a weird, somber kind of down to earth video, and this happened to be one of them. And it got into why YouTube went down.
What? When did it go?
Do you remember? I don't know. Well, it was about a month and a half ago, 2 months ago. YouTube went down for like half a day.
Maybe.
I might watch a lot more YouTube than you do.
I watch quite a bit, but I might have missed that day.
YouTube is my background noise. Like when I'm working, I'll throw up like gaming videos and stuff in the background and I just let them play. So I noticed it was down and a lot of people noticed. And have you ever seen like when YouTube goes down, you get that giant like vomit block of text that's like a giant error message?
Yes.
So that's what everybody was getting.
I like the fail whale better, personally.
You know, I'm of the mindset that, you know, people go on Twitter and they freak out, you know, when Facebook went down, what, 3 days ago, 4 days ago?
That was so great. That was so great.
The little respite we got. Facebook go down. Twitter doesn't go down as much as it used to. You know, Git, when Git goes down, when Slack goes down, people freak out. And of course, when YouTube goes down, people freak out. And he put up a post that was like, here is why I think it went down. And Markiplier is not a web developer. He's not like a guy that I would call technical in that way. But he had an idea, and I just thought it was really interesting. You know, of course, Google Plus. And you know Google Plus is going away. You knew this, yes? Please tell me you knew this.
I've been trying to repress these things. I'm still mad about Google Reader, seriously.
Yeah, see, we've been over all this, yeah. So Google Plus is going away. Google said, you know what, it's not doing what we need it to do. It's wasting resources, whatever. We're getting rid of it. We've already queued up tickets at work to rip it out of all of our code and places we've got it for sharing and stuff. But they're saying, we're going to get rid of Google Plus. Mm-hmm. Markiplier's theory was that they started shutting down little parts of that infrastructure, and that's what brought YouTube down.
I could see that.
And his theory, and I'll leave a link in the show notes if you want to see the way his theory breaks down. It's kind of fascinating, like one of those ways that you wouldn't expect somebody without that technical expertise to think about it. But
right. He
basically goes into this idea that, you know, when Google Plus launched, Google went all in on
it. They really did. Yeah.
They integrated it into everything. And if you wanted to comment on YouTube videos,
right. You
had to have a Google Plus account.
And if you had an existing YouTube account, and then when Google Plus rolled out, you had to merge it in with your Google Plus account.
You had to combine them, yes.
Yeah.
So YouTube in particular, I think maybe even more so than other parts of the Google infrastructure, YouTube really was anchored, I think, into a lot of that infrastructure. And so his theory is they shut down a part of it, didn't fully test that shutdown, and as a result, broke part of YouTube and didn't know how to fix it right away, which is fascinating and possibly very correct, I think. The timing works, the idea works. He goes into a lot more information about like how his back end, like he has pages that he can't even look at because they are just broken.
Weird.
Now, he's got millions of subscribers and stuff like this. So, you know, some of that may just be that YouTube doesn't necessarily handle the scale of the top 20 YouTubers or something. But it's just a very interesting idea.
Why are they shutting it down now? I mean, it's been failing for years.
There's a whole post. Well, I'll link to that, too, in the show notes. I don't have it up in front of me. But it's kind of one of those, like, just eventual admissions of, you know what? Yeah, it's, you know, I mean, and here's the thing, right? When you are Google and you put something like Google Plus out there, I mean, it does kind of have to sit for a while because people do build on it, do rely on it, do all those things that, you know, make it hard to shut it down, even though you know it's going away and it's dead and it's not meant for the long term.
I really liked Google Plus initially. Like, I thought it gave you a lot of privacy controls and things that Facebook and whatnot didn't. I liked the circles. I liked how I could like kind of purpose share the things that I share with people. But man, they just really like all of their products, they just did not do the marketing correctly.
It's a weird duck, and that may be like a good retrospective kind of episode at some point to go more in depth into the failure of Google Plus. Because it is interesting. They definitely did some things very well. But apparently not enough. And I think that's right. I think, you know, it didn't catch on in the right ways and didn't do the right things.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's an interesting goose, to say the least. So it's an interesting video. Go check it out if you have any interest. If you're just interested in general in like systems integrations kind of stuff, when you look at like the reliance on Google Plus that YouTube had, that I think is interesting and how that can impact how you may build something in the future and what you rely on. Mm-hmm. I know just at a very low level, we've had that problem with Twitter, you know, building on the Twitter API. And when you don't keep really close attention to like an API change, things can break. And that's a very like watered down kind of problem to have, but it is sort of on the same spectrum, it's on the same continuum of issues. So yeah, that's That's the thing. That is the takeaway. So,
hmm.
Let's see what else. I guess we got something else to talk about this evening. So we have a guest this evening.
What?
Whoa.
We do this once in a while when we want to get squirrely. And let me tell you, I like being squirrely.
Sean,
hey,
you've been on the show before.
I have. On
build process number 2. Link in the show notes.
We will link that. Yeah, if you aren't familiar with Sean's work and what he does, go back to Build Process. Check out that episode. But I think we can also tell you a little bit more about him. We're not going to make you go back and listen to that. Though, yeah, please, yeah. By all means, do.
Yeah. So, Sean, tell us a little about yourself.
Sure.
What you do.
Yeah, so what can I tell you? I've got really wide feet.
You do.
I do. I have, yeah. What else? I have a pet name for my favorite towel and my favorite pillow.
What is it? Is it the same thing? Is your favorite towel also your favorite pillow?
I don't think you can say that on this show.
Yeah, I don't think I can say them on the show. No, it's nothing crazy. My you know, my pillow or my towel's green, and it's a giant beach towel, so I call it Big Green. Like, where's Big Green? I need to take a shower.
It's always nice when I can record an episode and know I'm not the weirdest guy on the show.
Well, if you record with Aaron, so I think you're safe.
Yeah. Usually he's the weirder guy on the show.
Yeah. I don't know. I'm Canadian. I've lived in China a couple times. That's interesting. I work for the government, same place Aaron works.
Yep.
And you know, I started.
They can't tell you or they'll have to kill you.
Have to process you through a queue, and that can take a while.
Yeah.
I feel like that joke is probably to somebody who works in government. Is probably as like trite and threadbare as people asking like if Dorothy is living next door to me or whatever.
Except when it's like legitimate. Like I know that I don't have that level of clearance, but I'm sure there are some jobs that, you know, they would have to kill you if they told you. Nowhere near what I work on though.
No, yeah. I help refugees, so it's kinda good stuff. And I started this thing that I think we're gonna talk about Ruby for good, mm-hmm. So let's kinda
Good so, stuff. Like, what, I mean, obviously I know what it is, but can you talk just very quickly, you know, the 30-second summary of what Ruby for Good is for those
definitely.
Just tuning in?
Yeah, definitely. It's it's an all-inclusive event, and it's not just an event, but most people know of the events where we get together for a long weekend. Like, it's all-inclusive, so your room, your food, everything's covered. And we build software for nonprofits, like, basically people that really need our help but never be able to afford us. You know, animal shelters, food banks, mm-hmm. diaper banks, places like that. Mm-hmm. And, but you know, we don't just, it's not a hackathon. Hackathons are horrible, toxic events. we have a hard stop every day at 5. And then we do stuff like we play board games. We sing karaoke. I showed a great video of Aaron singing karaoke.
Oh, do not.
I'll get a link for the show notes.
Please don't.
yeah. I'm like, I'm sitting on the edge of my seat here.
Oh my God. It's so horrible. I was very intoxicated.
I actually showed that video in my Strange Loop talk.
Oh my God.
And they were singing Cyndi Lauper, and at the end, you know, people were, you know, they were laughing, and but I said, you know, hey, they were still better than Cyndi Lauper. I got so many boos. I didn't expect there to be that many Cyndi Lauper fans at Strange Loop. But yeah, so we kick off these all these fun projects like during this event, and then we continue working year round. Mm-hmm. That's the 30-second plus.
So how many like projects are there sort of under the umbrella of Ruby for Good at this point?
I'd have to go and audit. Like there's different. There's quite a few, but like the problem with like it's not a problem, but like a lot of the nonprofits we help, like they're very not technical, and so like once we build something and deliver it, like they don't really know what else they need. And so they're just happy, and you know, they internalize the process, and then they don't want anything else. And so we have a lot of projects that are kind of just sitting there, but then we have a few kind of projects that are active and being worked on and like gaining, you know, always looking for more contributors and things like that.
Sean, right. tell us about the one with the voicemail. Oh. This is so great. Yeah. This is such a great example.
Yeah. And so like there was a nonprofit that helps people with like mental illness and, you know, like things like schizophrenia or even like maybe soldiers who've returned with like PTSD, but it helps them like find and keep housing. And like, I went in to meet with these people and they thought we were going to be building them like a volunteer management application, like something like tracking hours and whatnot. But while I was sitting there talking to this lady, Lauren, there was this phone ringing in their office, and it was ringing and ringing, and like no one was answering it. And after about an hour and a half, I finally asked her, I'm like, hey, why doesn't anyone answer that phone? And it turns out that that phone was like their ticket tracking system. So like people were calling in, leaving messages, and they were like calling in to like listen through messages. And sometimes they'd have to like fast forward through like 80 messages before they found the one they wanted. And like, and they would have to, and the only way they could verify the job had been finished is if like the message was gone. Cause you couldn't delete a message until, you know, the work had been completed. And they had all these like business processes like built into this, you know, this answer machine. And like, I don't even know why like the phone was plugged in. It didn't have to be plugged in. And so, you know, so like after meeting with them, it's like, that's what we're building for you and fixing. Mm-hmm. And it was, you know, it was a basic CRUD app, like, you know, like a couple other things, like some upload and like maybe like email notifications and things like that. But really, like anyone who's been doing what we do for 3 months could have built what we built them. But like they've told me that it saves them probably, you know, 100 hours a month of people's time, which is just amazing.
Mm-hmm. Isn't it weird how people's minds solve problems when they mm-hmm. aren't like specialized in that area, like what they think is a good solution and the trail they go down to get there. So that takes us, I think, into the meat and potatoes, though, right? Because
yeah.
you guys have a project that you do under Ruby for Good
yeah.
that is based on diapers.
Yes.
Of all things to have like this sort of topic on, but it has come up several times, I think, over the past yeah. few episodes that we like have, we make these sort of casual references to diaper base, right?
Right.
So let's talk about like, where did that start? Like, what is the origin of diaper base?
Yeah. So it started with, and you know, like Aaron will take over, but it started with this lady, Rachel, who I knew from when I used to live in Oregon. She was actually my neighbor. Great lady, super sweet. And like Rachel started a diaper bank. And like, if you're not familiar, like about a third of families in the US have problems affording diapers for their kids. And like Rachel told her story that she was, you know, she was in a grocery store one time buying diapers and milk for her kids and got up to the till and she only had enough money to pay for one. And so, you know, she bought food because, you know, can't not feed your kids, you know, put the diapers back, you know, she went home and she cried and, you know, she didn't, you know, she never wanted anyone else to be in that situation. And so, you know, she, you know, started a diaper bank and, you know, and it's a growing thing. Like they're predicting in a few years, there's going to be as many diaper banks as there are food banks. Mm-hmm. And so we said, hey, we're going to build something and you know, to help you and make your life easier. Cause if you meet Rachel, you can realize she's just like this super smart, super talented. Like she could be doing anything. Like she could be running like a Fortune 500 company. Like she is so smart. But you know, she's helping people. So we said, hey, this is going to be one of our projects. We're going to help you. And then we put Aaron said, hey, I want to lead a team. And so like, hey, Aaron, meet Rachel.
Yeah. It's also worth noting that diaper banks don't get, like, there's no WIC program or government assistance program for diapers. So diaper banks are kind of like in like pioneer territory. They're not like publicly backed or anything. There are grants and things, but it's not the same as like food banks.
Well, and they make such a big difference. And like, I'm sure Aaron was probably going to talk about this, but like in people's lives, like if you don't have diapers for your kids aren't allowed to be in daycare. And there's so many mm-hmm. things. And like, you know, if your kids can't be in daycare that day, you can't go to work, you can't earn money. And like, you just see how this could be such a, you know, like it's such a big problem for families and like the gap here that diaper banks are filling. So
it's, you might say it's even bottom heavy.
Oh, okay. Wait, with that, I have to say the first year of the app we did, it was just for PDX Diaper Bank for the Portland one. And then the second year, Sean and I had been talking over the summer and we said, like, we should like think bigger and make this multi-tenant for all the diaper banks. And so like I gutted the original app. I took out the parts that we had written, like the main core logic, and then like rebuilt it as like a very bare bones multi-tenant or bare bones app period. But when we pitched it at the first year Ruby for Good, we pitched it as a green and brown field project.
Let's take a second too, to just, if you aren't familiar with the phrase multi-tenant, it basically means you're building a platform that can serve multiple users.
Yes.
As opposed to something that's designed to serve one person.
GitHub, for example, would be multi-tenant. Right. Or even Facebook.
And a lot of that came from Rachel, too. She had shown off what we'd built for her. And because a lot of the, like most diaper banks have the exact same, you know, inventory problem that we solved. You know, she showed it off and they all wanted it. And it didn't make sense to spin up, you know, 50 different instances. So that's why, you know, it's like, mm-hmm. hey, let's you know, that's why the conversation happened, that we should rebuild it as a as multi-tenant.
It goes back, and we brought this up a few times, and you can go look up the episodes. We've talked about like learning to code and getting involved,
mm-hmm.
and how sometimes one of the best ways you can learn how to code is to just find a problem you want to solve, even if that's a personal problem or whatever the case may be. It may never amount to much of anything, but this is the kind of thing that we're talking about. Is that that could start as a very grassrootsy sort of. Oh, I'm part of an organization, you know, maybe it's an animal rescue, maybe it's a food bank, maybe it's any of these kinds of things, and you want to help them solve that problem.
Mm-hmm.
That's how this kind of stuff starts, is you're just trying to solve this one little area, and it grows in usefulness. And that's, you know, it's very interesting to see a case of that that is very real life in terms of...
I had no idea that the app would be where it is today when we first, like when we first built it the first year, or when we built it, like when we redid it the second year. It's currently in it's after its third year of development. So we're approaching our fourth year.
Wow.
And I had no idea that it would be, like, it would grow as far as it has. It's been like an amazing experience to work on it.
So Sean, you mentioned that you basically went to Aaron, so to speak, and had him kind of take on that process of shepherding the project. But obviously there's a group of people who help contribute to this project. How did you find like the other developers then that started kind of coming into this nucleus?
Oh, definitely. Well, so like that's kind of part of the original like group of developers, like that happens at, you know, the Ruby for Good event where all the attendees come and like they self-select onto teams. So we let all the teams make a pitch. So Aaron got up there and said, "Hey, I'm helping diaper banks, and like this is, you know, this is what diaper banks do." And then someone else gets up there and says, "Hey, I'm helping an animal shelter, and this is what the animal shelter does. And I'm helping like the homeless children's playtime project," and so on and so forth. And then people just self-select on the teams, and so like that was where the first like 10 or so developers come. And one of the nice things too, like now that like Ruby for Good has been around for like 5 years or 5+ years, is that like we have a reputation in the community. So we get a lot of people who just come by and they want to contribute. And like, it's a really special thing that now we can, like, we just post issues in our GitHub repos, and within a day or two, someone will just grab it and say, "Oh, I'll help with this," or "I'll work on this."
Mm-hmm.
And so like we don't have enough work for the amount of people who want to contribute to our stuff, which is, you know, which is, I feel, is a really good testament to what a great community the Ruby community is.
So in last month was Hacktoberfest, as we mentioned last episode, and when Sean and I were at, it was also when the National Diaper Bank Network conference was, where we pitched. I would create issues, you know, during the day, you know, just things that I noticed while getting ready for our pitch on Friday. Like on Wednesday and Thursday, I was just creating issues, and then I'm not even kidding, within 15 minutes, someone had grabbed it. And then another half an hour or so later, there'd be a PR submitted, a pull request. And it was phenomenal. I mean, I know a lot of that is driven by the fact that it was Hacktoberfest, and I was judiciously tagging the issues with the appropriate tags for people to find them. But I'll take it.
Yeah, that's, you know, and for the folks who think about this stuff, because I do this a lot, like, and to throw back to last episode, my admission that I didn't take part in Hacktoberfest, despite both prior to that talking about how I was looking forward to it. But I think that's a good lesson, because you talk about Ruby for Good kind of being the, you know, the, what do you want to call that, the oven for some of this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You need to, if you're a developer who does want to work on this kind of stuff, sometimes you do have to set that kind of time aside and say, you know what, I'm going to go take part in this project or this program that helps me organize my thoughts and my time and my thinking so that I can commit it to something. Because otherwise, I find it very difficult. I work all day. I have side projects I work mm-hmm. on. I want to find time to do things I enjoy that are just for me. And so it becomes very hard to find time to commit to the other things that I wish I had time to commit to.
So regarding that, this I think is something that people might find useful. If you're working on, if you're maintaining an app on GitHub, especially when you make your issues, you want to really detail it as much as possible, like so that no questions have to be asked of anyone, because people who, like you just mentioned, they just want to, like, they don't have a lot of time. They don't want to have to wade through all of your code. They just want to come in, find something they can snag, and then do it, and then, you know, put up the PR and get the internet points for it.
Right. Because you never know who may jump on that ticket.
Right. Exactly. Exactly.
How do you, let's talk about the PR side of it, pull requests and things, mm-hmm. and like people who are submitting code to tickets that maybe you don't know who they are. What is... What is this process for figuring out, like, when somebody sends a pull request, how do you even decide what makes it in the master? Because we've talked a lot in the past weeks, and not necessarily on the show, like, just in the wild, about Gutenberg, for instance, and WordPress, right. and some of the accessibility stuff, and what the core team gets to decide, and things like that. Now, WordPress, huge, you know, everybody wants yeah. to be a part of that pie. But on a smaller project, right, somebody may come in, fork your project and think, oh, we need to solve this problem for our diaper bank. But it maybe is a super unique, like, one-off kind of case, but they do a request anyway. How do you manage yeah.
We haven't decisions? Had that kind of issue happen yet. The only pull request we've ever had to reject was during Hacktoberfest, and it was one that was submitted and it was tagged with issue number one, which was closed long, long ago. And that issue was creator readme, Sean, who closed it. And this person added like three words onto a line in the readme file.
Yeah, it was like, give it your best effort or something.
Yeah. And I was like, Sean had some choice words for that. I responded with, you know, just, thank you for your interest in this project. This issue has already been closed, but you should see open issues and find one that suits you. Yeah. And I would love to see a PR for any of them.
And maybe that's the lesson there, right? Is that a lot of projects maybe never have to worry. You know, you may not even a good size, like what you might consider a well-used project, mm-hmm. may not ever get to the size where they have to worry about, like, man, I don't know if we want to keep this in there. You're probably going to be happy just to have whatever contributors you have, which is not to, you know, disparage any projects or anything. I think that's just the reality of, well, yeah, we'll get into the size of GitHub and their 31 right. million users over time. But, you know, you probably will just enjoy the folks who help.
Every once in a while, we'll get PRs come in that aren't specifically tied to issues. And it's like, you know, someone who happened to do some spelunking on the app and realized, like, oh, you know, this thing could be optimized better. Or yeah, like
by adding Docker or something.
Oh, my God. We'll get to that in a minute. but they'll occasionally submit a PR like that. And if they document what they did well and it's not too breaking of a change and it does do the thing they say it's going to do and the test suite passes, like, we'll usually merge them in. And I really... I prefer to accept pull requests more often than reject them, because I want to encourage involvement in the app.
Sure.
And I'll respond with, like, you know, if their pull request is missing something, like there's not tests for something and the tests have to be written, or if, like, they do something is like, well, you know, this is good, but, like, we really need you to do this, like, because it's like, if you don't do it, I'm gonna have to do it, and I don't have the time right now,
right?
And then I'll usually make that, but as long as they're making a good faith effort, like, I like to accept the pull request and get people to get in there, because if they submit one PR and they get accepted, that kind of incentivizes them to submit another one,
right? They're much more likely to get involved.
Yeah,
then. Yeah, like, it's part of, like, the community building. And, like, and I mm-hmm. posted in our Slack here our contributing file, and, like, and that's the same contributing file we put in all the Ruby for Good things. Mm-hmm. And, like, we basically start with the code of conduct, because that's the most important thing. But, you know, then we say, it's like, hey, like, just give it your best effort, because, you know, like, mm-hmm. part of our mission is, you know, education and growing people and growing developers. And, you know, you can't do that if you're turds. you know. And there are some turds on the internet, and I'm not you know saying Linus or anything like that, but you know they're out there.
It all kind of feeds in the next question I was going to raise here, but you kind of answered it before I even got to it, is how you keep people engaged. And that's encouraging them, right? You just,
yeah,
you know, you, yeah, you look at their pull requests, you find ways to, you know, include that if you can. Odds are early on, especially, you can. And even if you can't, Aaron, your answer, I think earlier, was great in mm-hmm. that you're like, well, this is not exactly what we're looking for, mm-hmm. but here's how. It's like, we have a philosophy at work that, you know, you never say no. It's no, right. but right. let's figure out how to
no buts.
Direct that energy. Like, even if it's a bad suggestion, maybe we can, no, we're not going to do that, but we could do this.
So we did have, I don't know if it was a pull request. Or no, actually it was. So there was a second pull request we had to reject. I forgot about this one. You mentioned Docker earlier. So at Ruby for Good last year, someone had just done a drive-by PR of adding a Docker file, and they asked if it was okay. And I was like, is this going to change anything? And he's like, no, it's just a file. If people want to use it, they can. I was like, okay, whatever, cool. And I didn't anticipate this, but the first day, I would say we spent half the evening on onboarding night, like the very first night. We just had a couple hours before games just to get the app cloned down. And we spent a lot of time trying to get people's Docker environments set up. And like, I don't have much experience with Docker. I have a little bit, but not very much. And then the second day, it was half the morning was spent debugging Docker issues. And it was really pulling away hours from actually developing. And, you know, one person who was trying to do it, she was just struggling getting Docker work. And I was like, wait, oh, you're using Docker? Oh, well, here, just clone the app down. Okay, start up Postgres, hit Rails S. Okay, you're good. And that was it. It was like literally took 30 seconds, not even joking. Yeah. 30 seconds, and they were up and going. I know that Docker has its place, and I'm not knocking it, but for our app specifically, we've tried it, and it's not a net positive. And so we had a PR coming in that was like adding a Docker file. And I was like, okay, so we removed it. Here's the PR where we removed it. And here's the issue where we discussed it. Thank you. But we're going to have to hard pass on this. And then I actually added Docker file to the git ignore. So if people want to use Docker on their local devs, they totally can, but then it won't go get committed to the repo.
Right. That's an interesting idea too, and that's something else we can maybe get into a little bit more in the technical side. I want to hit one more thing before we go to break, sure. And that's logistically, and this I think is an important logistical, is how do at scale. Now, for a small project, for a small website, if you're a developer, you probably have a way of already handling this. But like Diaperbase has been growing. Aaron, you and I talked on the show previously about how you basically got 10% of your market cornered for that app.
We're up to what, 39 diaper banks now, Sean?
Yeah.
So we've grown 13 more since that last time we talked about it. So we've 50% increase.
How do you pay for it? Because not GitHub. Like GitHub, it's a public project. You don't have to pay for a public repo. But like for the hosting, for, you know, where the app lives, you have to obviously maintain a server of some kind. What is your like monetization scheme look like so that you can ensure that when somebody logs in tomorrow, they can access that app?
So, but we're really lucky that we have, we get $5,000 a year of Microsoft Azure sponsorship. And so like that is paying for all our servers and for the different apps, like, you know, the diaper app and the partner app. And so we're really lucky that there's no costs because we, like, you know, none of us are paid and we don't make any money from this. Yeah.
Right. In fact, it's free. I mean, the app, when we pitched it to people at the conference, you know, they would ask how much it costs. And we would just say it's free forever, full app access. We're trying to figure out monetization for like, you know, monthly sponsorships. There's only 217 diaper banks with the Diaper Bank network. I don't know how many there are that aren't in the network, but like there's, even if we were to charge, you know, $100 a month or whatever, I mean, if we're trying to be a self-sustaining organization with this, I don't think that membership fees are sufficient. And a lot of these diaper banks couldn't afford that anyway.
And right. a company like Pampers can afford to maybe come in and
sure
jingle right. the pocket a little bit, so to speak.
Absolutely.
I don't really know what that phrase means. So that's probably a good good chance to say, you know what? We're going to step away for just a second. We're going to go let our sponsor speak, and we're going to come back here, and we're going to talk about the technical side of this, and we'll revisit the PR stuff, the testing suite stuff, and a few other things, including Docker, maybe, if we have time. So we will talk about all of that coming back after the break. The Drunken UX Podcast is brought to you by our friends at NewCloud. Are you trying to build a case around an interactive map for your school, city, or business? NewCloud's interactive map platform gives you the power to make and edit a custom interactive map in just minutes. Their team of professional cartographers specialize in map illustrations and are ready to design a rendering to fit your exact needs. One map serves all your users' devices with responsive maps that scale and blend in seamlessly with your website. Visit them online to request a demo at nucloud.com/drunkenux. That's nucloud.com/drunkenux. I need to explain to my friends listening out there in podcast land that we are trying to record this while the Chiefs are playing the Rams. And those of you who have known me or talked to me or ever looked at my Twitter know that I'm a huge Chiefs fan. And we're going in the halftime up a point right now. No, he missed the extra point. I'm literally looking at it. He missed it. We're going in tied at halftime. I can tell you, the only... Brooke Lottie has one redeeming quality. One. It is alcohol. So it is doing the job that it is meant to do, just not in a way that I find entirely enjoyable.
I think that they should put that as the subheading for the on the label. It's technically alcohol.
It's technically alcohol. It won't make you go blind, probably.
Sean, what was that saying? Beer before liquor, you only get sicker.
No, liquor before beer, coast is clear. Beer before liquor, don't be a little whiner or something. It was something else.
Yeah. I don't like beer. I've never been a beer drinker, but folks who have listened know that, you know, once in a while I'll have like cider, you know, if I'm going to take it easy that evening. I love cider, but I am pretty much cider, scotch, or an occasional mixed drink somewhere in there. Mm-hmm. But last week was one of the mixed drink exceptions, but I drink a lot of scotch. Like, I probably drink an unhealthy amount of scotch here in another 20 years.
It's over a long period of time.
So we have Sean Marcia. Is that
yes?
Is that
wow,
correct?
Great.
Well, I live in Kansas. We speak bad Spanish here. But your name is Sean, so that's not Spanish. But whatever. Okay. So we are talking about Ruby for Good vis-a-vis Diaper Bank. So we're kind of getting there's sort of two topics kind of rolled in here. But the idea is talking about how you run an open source project and how, you know, there are organizations out there designed to help you run open source projects. Mm-hmm. And so the second half here, we're coming back and we're going to talk more about the technical side. Now, we talked about the logistical, where stuff comes from, where the ideas come from, how you find that kind of thing, how you get other people involved, how you encourage them and all of that. So you are jumping in now. I don't really know how that's a thing, but some people maybe do. That's kind of weird. You're weird if you do that. I'm looking at you on Spotify. I see those statistics, and I don't entirely understand them, but okay.
So they're skipping ahead halfway through to see if I've made a funny joke yet.
And have I clicked? Did I click when we came back in? I think we did. Okay. So let's start with the biggest, most obvious question that's out in front, which is obviously Diaper Bank is a project of Ruby for Good. Obviously, any project coming out of Ruby for Good is built on Ruby.
Yes.
So is the decision, let's just take that kind of abstracted, like the choice to do a project and say, well, we're going to do it for Ruby or with Ruby, outside of the Ruby for Good component, was it just sort of, did you make that decision opportunistically? Was it where, you know, just available skill sets were? What did Ruby offer you something that you thought was unique? Like, what was the thought process that went behind saying, you know what, Ruby on Rails is what we're going to use?
Well, I'll let Sean answer in a moment with more general about the conference, but I can say that I love coding in Ruby, especially Rails, a lot of fun. But more importantly, when we only have a weekend to work on something, like if you know how, if you're comfortable with Rails and you know how it works, you can spin up something quite functional and you know, a decent amount complete very quickly. You can, I mean, I don't know why it's called on Rails specifically, but I always kind of assumed that it's because if you follow the yellow brick road, you get to the Emerald City quickly. That's a really bad analogy.
No, well, I mean, Rails is the server piece of it. It'd be kind of like saying PHP on Apache.
Yeah. Right? No, it'd be more like saying PHP on WordPress.
Or PHP on Laravel.
Yeah. Yes. Okay. Yes. That's a better analogy. Yeah.
I'm not a Ruby dev, so don't listen to my analogies there.
Like C# on .NET, maybe.
So does that have, obviously that had no impact though, like from a stack standpoint and given your earlier conversation, I was going to go into the containerization sort of discussion in terms of, you know, making it easy for people to pick up and do their own work on. But obviously for this case, that doesn't necessarily apply.
There's a couple things though too. It's like our apps are Ruby on Rails, and all the dev, like, and all everything we build is Ruby on Rails. Like, even if you're a dev from another language or whatnot, because like you do, like, it is a force multiplier effect if everyone's working in the same language rather than, you know, like, so, you know, this app is PHP, this one is Python, this one is Ruby, because, you know, then you can build off each other. You have access to like all these people. And like, even though it's Ruby and Rails, like there are other things you can do. You know, you can, like, you obviously have the choice of database. Oh, am I going to use, you know, React, Vue, Ember? You know, like, are you going to use a JavaScript framework? Like, all these kind of things. And our, like, what we do is we always, like, we're very intentional to always do the, like, conventions. And so if someone wants, like, because I know, like, there's always, like, people want to do, like the new hotness. It's like, oh, I really want to use Vue in this app. And so, like, when after we make the introductions, you know, we introduce Aaron to Rachel, and then Aaron comes back and says, okay, this is how I'm going to build it. And then if Aaron says, I'm going to use Vue, and I'm going to use MySQL, not Postgres, and I'm going to, you know, like, do all these things, like we're not going to say, no, you can't do that. But, you know, we're going to push back on him and, like, really make him justify those decisions, because like, Aaron, you know, he can be gone in a few weeks, and we're going to keep maintaining this. And if you're using all these, like really like esoteric things, or even just like, not that even like React is esoteric, but like, if you need like a Rails and a React developer, like, that's less common than just a Rails developer, or just a React. Right. And so, yeah.
We always use the analogy at work to that, you know how places say, well, if you ever get hit by a bus, that's a problem. We actually have that is struck from our lexicon at work. It's, we have to say, if you win the lottery.
Yeah, that's lottery. I like that so much better.
We keep it upbeat. Something great happened to you, but now we have to take care of the crap that you built. So
right,
at least help us a little bit there.
Speaking further about what Sean was just talking about with the convention. So if you're unfamiliar with Rails specifically, there's a whole like, one of the main idioms of the language, of the framework, is this idea of convention over configuration. And so that yellow brick road that takes you to the Emerald City is like the Rails way, per DHH, the guy that created Rails. He's a very interesting and opinionated fellow. Whether you agree with or not, he has interesting things to say. But so the Rails has all these conventions, and it's with the, you know, how the app is organized, and like, if you do things the conventional way, then things are very, very easy, and you can make a lot of assumptions, and you can just move very quickly through the app.
Right.
But occasionally you have to, like, deviate from that a little bit, and it happens. And when you have experience with it, you know when it's okay to do that. It just creates a little bit more, like, maintenance or considerations that you have to be aware of.
Yeah. So where, in terms of, like, now that you've decided on your stack, the next logical step is, now I need to put it somewhere. So, and you mentioned, you know, with some of the grant money, program money that you've got through Azure, where did you start your hosting at, and, like, where are you now with it as far as that that idea goes and that thinking goes.
I can speak to that. The very first year when we did it for just Portland, her primary website was on Bluehost, I think. And I spent a good portion of that first evening just trying to get the app like deployed successfully, just even just getting it running on Bluehost. And Bluehost, if you don't know, is a shared host environment like DreamHost or other ones. And shared host environments do not play well with Rails because of the way that, because they often lock down the Ruby version and you can't always install RVM, which is a let's use different versions of Ruby. And they also, it's hard to install the gems. Sometimes you have to use like libraries and install packages and make it work. It's just not a good time.
Right. It sounds very much like if you're doing development with something like Gulp and Node and NPM and all that, there's dependencies. And this kind of comes back to this sort of whole technical discussion, which is the stack you choose may dictate what you have to have, right? Because you, to run a Ruby app, you need a level of support from your host that you may not get from a $3 a month type of host.
Exactly. So one of the guys on the team, Keith Walters, he's awesome. He helped us. We got approval from Rachel to do DigitalOcean. It's like we did the $5 a month plan. So we set it up on Dio, and Keith set up the Capistrano, which is like the deployment script thing. And then that evening, then finally at 10 or 11 p.m. or whatever, then I got to go and join everyone else playing games. But I was like determined. I did not want to go into Friday morning telling people, well, you're all going to have to wait while we figure out how to deploy this.
It's funny to me because I'm a huge DigitalOcean fanboy. Every server I run now is hosted there. So I'm a
DigitalOcean is great.
I am a big fan. So what precipitated the move between DigitalOcean and Linode?
Sponsorship.
Yeah. They sponsored and they gave us really nice, like sometimes, you know, you get the DigitalOcean, like sign up and you get, you know, $20 of credit.
Right.
I think that they gave us like $60 of credit. And so with the $5 instance, because they just launched their $5 instances. So, so they gave us like a year free, which was fantastic. And again, like they've been rock solid. Like I have zero complaints about Linode and how good it's been and like availability and everything. Like I will recommend them to everyone. Yeah. And they sponsored the event. They sent t-shirts, all this kind of stuff. So yeah.
Both Linode and DigitalOcean are fantastic and I have had no problems with either one.
Yeah.
Let's dig into something you just said though. You mentioned that you had Capistrano scripts that helped you get things deployed. For those who don't know, I'm going to preface this. When I say more familiar, it's a very shallow pool we're talking about here, but I'm more familiar with Puppet, if that phrase means anything. What we're talking about are automation scripts for deployment that basically say, take this, run it, and when you're done running, it's kind of like, and here's where like the reason I want to bring it up, it's kind of like containerization in a way.
Yeah.
It's designed around getting something set up with everything you need. So that you run one script, right?
Let me describe back in Rails 2. I started using Rails in Rails 2 7-8 years ago or whatever. And when I started, we didn't yet have Capistrano. I think 6 months after I started learning Rails, that's when we used Capistrano. So I had to do a couple deployments pre-Capistrano. And this is the process. You have your current version of master or whatever. You have to go onto the server. You have to pull down the latest version. Then you have to run the migrations, change any like files or anything have to be changed. And then sometimes you have to restart the database server, depends on what you're using. And then you have to restart the Rails instance. And sometimes there's other steps you have to do as well, depending on your app. Like maybe you have to blow away your assets or whatever else. There's other things. With Capistrano, all you type, you do your kit, your commit, you do your push, you resolve any masters or merges you have to do with the master branch. And then you just type cap, like production deploy. That's it. And then it runs through it, like it logs into the server, it pulls the repo down, it does the migrations, it does the bundle, which is like gulp. It does all of the things, and then it tells you when it completes successfully. So it's amazing.
I think it's important to emphasize, though, that too, while on one hand that is fantastic, it makes things easier and streamlined stuff, I think it's also important to understand why that's useful. And we don't have to go into it necessarily, but I just want to the reason I bring it up is for people who are learning this stuff and are getting used to deploying apps or building an app and figuring out even how to put it somewhere, there's a lot of value in understanding all of those manual steps that you do, and then understanding why something like a Capistrano or a Puppet or one of those helps that process. And then consequentially, you know, getting into Jenkins or a CI type system that handles all of that for you. But if you don't know why that's useful and why those things help you out, I think you need to take a step back and learn that.
It's easy to cargo cult either of like Jenkins or Capistrano or anything and just be like, I type these words and things work.
Did you say cargo cult?
Cargo cult.
That is a phrase I have not heard, but I like it. I see what it implies and I like it.
Yeah, yeah. That's the way it's explained to me is the cargo boxes that would be dropped for like, you know, native tribes or whatever that are getting humanitarian relief, and they would just see like the airplane fly overhead and then the thing would fall out of it. And then so they would have like this whole like ritual and everything about summoning the flying bird that drops the food.
Wow.
And so, yeah, it's just the idea that, like, you have these steps that you do and you don't know why you're doing them, but you do them and then it produces the result that you like.
And I admit, like, and I think every developer admits to this at some point, that there is a certain muscle memory that comes to learning something, especially if you learn them out of order. And I've had this problem for a long time with, like, Gulp. And learning the idea of how a build process works. I'm better at it now than I used to be, certainly, but there definitely was a time where, because one of my other devs on my team is who built our build process in Gulp and all of that and got it set up. And I remember, like, I would type in, you know, npm install, and it would come up with, like, a error, fatal type stuff. And I'm just like,
RMRF, npm modules.
That's not what, yeah, exactly. That's not what's supposed to happen here, dude. Can you help me out a little bit? And we would sort it out. I'm better now, but I get that. I like that cargo cult. I'm gonna take that to work, and nobody's gonna know what I'm saying. But I'm gonna be like, "What? You don't know?" So this is somewhat logistical, but I think it's also somewhat technical. So I saved it for now, and I wanted to ask you guys how. And maybe the answer is simply Ruby, but how do you handle like coding standards, especially when you start thinking about, hey, random person X may come into my application and decide to make a pull request, and they may fix something that I need fixed, but I also want to make sure that it is clean and up to snuff for the way I'm building. How do you,
Sean, you want to talk about
how do you handle that?
RubyCop?
Yeah, so well, like we, you know, like since we're on GitHub and we have like Travis CI integrated, and we use a tool called RubyCop, which enforces like Ruby kind of style guides. Because obviously like, there are different ways, you know, do you use single quotes, double quotes? Do you, you know, like how do you format your code? And like we've made some decisions and we have RubyCop in our app, which will then like if you submit a pull request and there are RubyCop violations, like it'll show the build is failing. Or if, you know, if they submit a pull request where, you know, the tests are broken, you know, it'll also show us the build is failing. And so like that, like that's usually like our first kind of stop.
When you say it shows you the build is failing, where would a user see that?
So like you submit a pull request, and then like after your pull request, like right there on the pull request screen, like there's going to be a little, there's going to be either a couple big green check marks or a couple big red X's that are showing like the build is failing or the build is passing, or like, you know, like the safe to merge or.
Right. Okay. I just wanted to clear that up for folks.
Yeah. Sorry.
People who haven't used RubyCop before, RubyCop is a script that you run against your code base, and it applies like cops, which are style definitions. But RubyCop has a level of like pickiness that if it were a human, you would punch them in the face. Yes. It's like you run RubyCop and it's like, there are 500 violations, and like 300 of them are that you have a trailing white space at the end of all of these lines. Oh, and this one is because you use single quotes instead of double quotes. this one is because we think that every once in a while you get a useful one. Like, well, yeah. You use this method here. You should use like this method instead. It's like, oh, I didn't know I could do that. Thank you, RuboCop, but fuck you.
This all ties back, though, to what we started talking about in the first half, which is getting into... Sorry. No, you're fine. I'm just trying to make connections to stuff for people, which is testing suites, right? Continuous integration, CI stuff, coding standards, and testing suites all marry together sort of at a nexus of do good work. So how, like, same question in terms of in the case of Ruby, is it just like a natural, because I know Ruby has some built-in testing stuff that kind of comes along, but like, how does that get enforced? How do you handle making sure that folks are running tests, but not only running them, but writing them, things like that?
So like when someone submits a pull request, you know, if there aren't any tests and it's something that, you know, requires tests, you know, we gently ask if you can also write some tests for that. And obviously too, like sometimes like it's something where, you know, they won't know how to write tests. And so, you know, we'll invite them into Slack and have a discussion about it. Like we were using a geocoding service, like, which is a service that will, like, it takes in an address and then it spits out like, longitude and latitude. And like the person just didn't know how to write tests for that. Cause you know, it is kind of an edge case thing. A lot of people probably haven't written tests for that.
I will say that with, I mentioned earlier about creating issues and having detailed explanations. One of the things that I write in an issue, like I'll do like the, if it's a bug issue, I'll be like, okay, this is what it's doing. This is what we need it to do. But whether it's that or an enhancement, I'll also include like a criteria for completion, which includes like, you know, do the thing and also write a test that proves that this works, write a test that proves that this doesn't happen given these inputs.
Yeah.
So I'll kind of help people with like, this is the test I need you to write.
Right.
Right.
Well, and like one of the things I said earlier that, you know, like one of the things that makes it easy to contribute to the project is that it does have a good test suite, like a very, like very robust and very like complete. And so, and cause like testing is just like it is code and you know, people can be opinionated in how they test and they test in different ways, but because there is such a good suite of tests, it makes it really easy for someone to, it's like, okay, I want to test this controller. I want to test this model or, you know, this, like the, you know, so they can go and easily see like how we're doing it in other places and, you know, like, you know, kind of copy and paste or get a sense and, you know, like, so they don't have to, you know, do guesswork or, so it's not difficult for them.
Yeah.
It also adds to the, like when you're adding a new feature or if you're new to the project or something, you can look at the test suite and you can say like, how is this supposed to work? And you can see like the tests each have like, you know, a title. It'll say like, oh, well, this model, like it's invalid if it doesn't have a name. Or like when you run this method that we have, like it should update these things, but it should not do this or something. And then you have the tests kind of provide
documentation
parameters. Documentation and then parameters for like, what's the universe that this app lives in? What are the expectations? Because, you know, you maybe you've seen some of these things before, like, oh, the name is required. Of course it is. But, you know, maybe other things like, well, the quantity for this is required, but only if this is also set. And so this sort of sets up, it makes it easier to spelunk the code, basically.
So let's, the testing suite kind of raises a question because testing is automated. Testing is code checking code. What about people checking code? Like when we get into things like questions of peer review. And so for instance, at one step of our process now at work, before our like code gets QA'd by actual QA, we have a physical review step where one of the other developers on our team has to look at our code. How do you handle, like in work, that's easy. That's part of our work process. But for an open source project, how do you do code review at all? Do you handle that? Is that something you look at?
Definitely.
Yeah. Every, well, like the only people that can merge in is, I think, are Aaron and I.
I think so, yeah.
Or maybe there's one or two.
I think Keith can too.
Yeah. But right. So the only things that get merged into master is if Aaron does it or I do it. So
when I see a PR come in, either Sean or I will do pull request reviews And I always, I look at who's submitting it first. And if it's Sean, like, I just look at what's changed just so that I know these things have changed. But I know, like, I know how Sean codes, and it's acceptable. And so
that's very generous.
It's sufficient. I'm familiar with Sean's, like, you know, level of proficiency, so I know that I don't have to look very closely. But when we have a very new person, especially in Hacktoberfest, I will look through. I'll click on files changed. It shows me the diff. I'll see what they added. I'll see what they removed. I will do line item comments if I see something that's like, well, you know, you did this and it took 3 lines. You can also just do this method, and it would do 1 line, because I'm going to do it if you don't.
Right.
Or like, you know, well, this is cool how you did this, but we need a test to prove that it works. And I look very closely at the pull request, because what I've learned is if you just approve every PR that comes in, it just creates more work for you later. And the person that submitted the code may not be around to fix the problem, but you want the app working, so you got to fix it. And so doing the review early prevents work that you have to do later
on. And if you don't know, like, GitHub, if you haven't used GitHub a ton, if you're still learning that system, the PR system there, like, it lets you, if you go in and look at it, next to every line of code, you can hit a little plus symbol, and it'll open up a comment box. So you can comment line by line and say, oh, hey, we need to adjust this or whatever. So if you're, whether you're the reviewer or the reviewee, you can get feedback on the stuff you are writing there, and should, I think, is I have generally found that to be a good experience from a, hey, this is the exact thing we need changed. Can you look at it?
One thing I will say, going back to the thing about automated testing, though, is that when I'm doing a review, all I have to look at is the files changed. I don't have to worry about whether or not the app works, because I trust the test suite that we collectively have written. And when they add new features and they have tests covering it, that maintains that trust network. And so when I have new PRs come in, all I have to do, I can do it from my phone. I have like a GitHub app on my phone. I just look through the PR and I look through the files changed, and if everything looks good and they submitted quality code and it's not like nothing that I have to feel like I have to change, then I'll be like, cool, thank you, you know. And I make it a point to respond to, you know, like, verbally comment on everyone's PR and thank them and everything. That's part of the community.
Yeah. And I want to add too, though, that it's not just Aaron and I doing all the code reviews. Like, there are a lot of, like, super great, great, fantastic people that, you know, like, I've seen in the last week, like, Michael's commented, JC, like there are a lot of people, like, looking over the pull request coming in, making comments, offering feedback. Like, it isn't just us. Like, it is a lot of great people. Yeah. Like Aaron and I are wonderful too, but like, there's a lot of great people, like, helping out. So it's not just us. Like, I'm not trying to steal anyone's credit.
Speaking of the quantity of people, I ran the stats on this. And if you didn't know, if you use Git, the command is git space dash short log space dash SNE. And that will give you the quantity and username of everyone that has committed, an accepted commit to whatever branch you're currently viewing. And so I ran that because we just recently released version 1.0 officially, like, release tag 1.0. And so I wanted to get a list of everyone that had committed. And we have 75 different users have committed to this app, which is awesome. And I kind of expected it would be a power law distribution, and it was.
Yeah, there's a long tail. And I think that's an important point for folks who are running an open source project, I think, is, you know, you will probably have, what, 2, 3, maybe 4, like, power contributors, but you will probably have a lot of people who jump in for one thing, because what they're going to do is they're going to use your tool, find one edge case that doesn't work for them, and fix that one edge case and never be back. And I'm guilty. I shouldn't say guilty. It's not a guilty thing. It's a very functional sort of way of approaching development, is this tool, I love everything about it except the one thing that it doesn't do that I need, so I'm going to fix that thing and give it back.
Like the analytics plugin.
Yeah.
That we use.
Yeah. And the reference he's making that what we use for tracking podcasts, I found a bug and I submitted it and fixed it. I want to ask, and this, we don't have to go down this rabbit hole, but I just want to ask the question real fast, because I don't know the answer with Ruby. I guess, do you guys use an IDE at all?
So I'm I now use RubyMind full time. I joined a team that works out of Pivotal Labs, and they use RubyMind there full time. And so, and since I pair like 8 hours a day, 5 days a week with people using RubyMind, and I've learned all the power of it, because it's an IntelliJ product, and so, which is a really powerful IDE that I've just kind of gotten used to it. And I'm still not an expert at it, but it is my de facto editor now when I'm reaching for something. Like, I'll still once in a while, like, you pull up my backup one is Visual Studio Code, but my primary one is,
The reason I ask is I just want to throw it out there to folks that if you aren't familiar with the phrase, it's an integrated development environment. And the idea is that it helps you in terms of, especially where I became familiar with the term was using Java. And what it helped with was like knowing what was referencing what, because you tend to have files referencing files, and functions that reference methods that reference constants that do all of these things. And IDEs help you tie all of that together and also help with things like, we have like check styles, if that phrase is useful. Where like things like you mentioned earlier, Aaron, like quotes and double quotes, single quotes, and those in some languages, double quotes, single quotes can mean very different things in terms of like variable interpolation and things like that. So having a standard for some projects can be very important. I don't think that's super important to go down, but if you are interested in deep development, I think you do at some point need to at least know when somebody says Eclipse or IntelliJ. I hadn't heard of RubyMind, but again, I'm not a Ruby dev, so that one didn't key with me. But
RubyMind is awesome, and I've seen it, and it's a great tool. I'm a creature of habit with my development environment, and so I have Sublime or sometimes VI, depends on the edit that I'm doing. But and then I'll have like a terminal with usually three tabs, and I have one for like command line normal like git commits, then I have one that tails the log that I'm working against, and I have one that is usually running guard, which just like every time I change a file it reruns the tests for that file, so I can see like if the change I did fixes the test entry. Sometimes I'll have a couple other tabs in terminal open. I'm sure RubyMind probably simplifies a lot of that, and maybe it would make me faster, but I have a thing that works for me. Yeah, that's what I do.
No, I get. I really get that. We've changed our default quote unquote editor for our team a couple times. We've settled on Atom, and I think that was a good choice. Like, I love Atom now, and I've gotten used to it. I get it. It works for me really well. But I understand I admit it. I'm a very muscle memory kind of guy. I do get used to sometimes running a command and not thinking about it. And the same is true for my development environment. And I keep trying to challenge myself in that area because I need to. I mean, that's, I need to stay good. I need to get good, as it were. Let me ask you real fast about, this is kind of a silly question, but we brought it up quite a while back in terms of open source projects and learning stuff, which is licensing, because that can be a struggle for people. And while it's not technical, it very much is. And maybe this was a logistical question, but let's spin our wheels for just a second. Like, what is Diaperbase licensed under? What does Ruby for Good encourage people to license under? Why? And how do you instruct people in figuring that out?
So, like, all our projects, we license them MIT.
Oh,
and like if right. yeah, and if you're not familiar, MIT is I think it's the most permissive. Basically, it's like here's the code. Take it if you want it. Do whatever you want with it.
It's like two paragraphs.
It's like take it if you want to use it if you want. You don't owe us anything. If you want to say thanks to us, cool. If you don't, that's cool.
Yeah,
and like in our thought is just
it's like like a hair shirt of public domain, yeah. basically.
Right. And because again, like our mission is, you know, to help people and help places. And, you know, like if they can take what we've done with this diaper base and help, help food banks, hey, more power to them or, mm-hmm. or whoever, like it's, you know, it's about helping and like whatever obstacles we can move, remove to do that.
I don't think that anyone is going to take our code and then release a better version and make money off of it because we currently offer it for free.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Like, right.
Beat that.
Okay. So let's wrap things up with a pretty little bow like we do here. We are getting to the end of the show, yeah. and I want to ask both of you, I feel like I'm almost doing like, this is almost an extended build process. I feel like I'm kind of interviewing both of you in a way. I get to ask a question and then listen to you guys wrap things up. What, like, are there any decisions that you would change? Like, this deep into the project now, do you look at anything and feel like it's either an anchor that's holding you back or, you know, a technical, what we call technical debt, you know, in terms of a, you know, a decision that you've made that has backfired? Is there anything like that, or do you feel like you've along the way made your choices and adjusted to those choices well and done the things?
I think the only mistake
canonical that, items. Yeah.
Actually, you know, you joke, but that has been like a very useful feature. Although I wish we would have named it differently.
Yeah,
I think using the word canonical was.
Yeah,
I would say the only thing I regret. Is that allowing Docker in that first time? I had no idea it would be such a pain in the ass.
Yeah,
at the conference.
It's so funny to hear that too, because that is exactly why you're supposed to use Docker is to avoid that.
Oh, it's on paper, it seems like precisely the right tool to use, and that's why I was like when I saw it come in, I was like, oh, yeah, that's cool, whatever. I had no idea that it would be. Requires so much like additional handling, and that was mainly to be more specific. The main problem people were running into was when certain tests would require, I think, disabling outbound network connections, and Docker was struggling with that, and so some of the tests weren't running correct. And really, I mean, the person who initially added Docker, like, they had no idea that would be an issue, and it's if you know how to do Docker yourself, it's fine. You can find a way around that. The problem is just that we had a lot of users who wanted to learn Docker and didn't know how to correct those things themselves. And then it just drew away focus from like working on the app.
Yeah. I think the important answer to this question, or rather acknowledgement of a non-answer, is that neither of you said, "All right, I would go back and not do it."
Oh no.
No, no.
I am 100% glad
that I'm
in this. Seriously.
And
it's
And we were super lucky that we were in beta for almost a year, and we had we had some amazing diaper banks helping us and giving feedback. Like we had built some things, like, you know, the canonical items I joked about. Like some things have been built in a way that like we didn't realize how some diaper banks would use the application. And then, which then caused things to break. But, you know, it was nice that we were in beta for like this long period, that we really were able to iron out all the kinks. And then now that we've gone live and, you know, we're like 39 diaper banks using it, like, and we have bug tracking software and whatnot, and we're not seeing any bugs, which is amazing. Like, it's a, I don't know, it's a testament.
So I'm going to co-op things here a little bit. And I'm going to preface this. This is not a paid advertisement and paid sponsorship, but it is the company I work for, but I want to promote it because it's an awesome thing in the same vein. And I know, Aaron, you've heard of this, but if you are interested in helping with web development or design or media production or anything to help benefit a nonprofit organization, I do encourage you to check out designingforgood.com. And what it is the company I work for, Aquint, we have a program every year where we give out $5,000 grants to somebody, designers, developers, all of these folks, to help go out into their community and either, you know, build a website for them, produce video and instructional materials for them, all of these different things. And the scope is broad. And all it takes to apply is a 90-second video explaining what you want to do and why for the organization. It's the easiest possible nice. $5,000 grant application you can ever go after. And I can't encourage people to look into it enough, whether that's abuse shelters, animal shelters, food banks, diaper banks, whatever that case may be. That's out there. You can check us out, designingforgood.com, and send us a video because you never know what good you can do. I mean, it takes 90 seconds to make the video. Well, more than that, but 90 seconds of video, real video time, and we'll give them $5,000 to work with you and build something great. So I wanted to take that, awesome. And that's my non-commercial commercial, so to speak. Stick with us here for about 60 seconds. We'll be right back. And if you can hear my dog in the background, that means my wife is also home from work. So take your time, whatever. Blah, 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 blah. Click, click. The Drunken UX Podcast is brought to you by our friends at NewCloud. NewCloud is an industry-leading interactive map provider who has been building location-based solutions for organizations for a decade. Are you trying to find a simple solution to provide your users with an interactive map of your school, city, or business? Well, NewCloud's interactive map platform gives you the power to make and edit a custom interactive map in just minutes. They have a team of professional cartographers who specialize in map illustrations of many different styles and are ready to design an artistic rendering to fit your exact needs. One map serves all of your users' devices with responsive maps that are designed to scale and blend in seamlessly with your existing website. To request a demonstration or to view their portfolio, visit them online at newcloud.com/drunkenux. That's nucloud.com/drunkenux.
Well, thank you for joining us this evening. Speaking for myself, it's been really awesome to talk about a project that's been something I've been waving over for the last 3
Speaking
and a half
for
years.
Myself, I've drank about a quarter of this whole bottle just tonight, so I'm just...
Rocks.
It looks empty. It looks
no,
like
no,
did
I did it.
It.
Mission accomplished.
What do you get at the bottom? Just disappointment.
I'll let you know tomorrow.
Regret. Yeah.
Sean, please, tell us, how do we find more about the thing?
Sure. If you want to check on Twitter, follow me. I'm just like Sean Marcia, or Ruby for Good. We have, there's also Python for Good. We are doing a West Coast event. You can go to rubybythebay.org, and there's rubyforgood.org, and both of them have links to our Slack room. You can just click on the little Slack item, get an invite, and come meet and chat and hang out with the nicest people on the internet, and me.
I'm also there.
Yeah. the nicest people. And so come do some good with us.
Hey, everybody, thanks for tuning in this week, and thanks for listening to us talk about Ruby for Good and Diaper Bank and all of those things. Be sure to check them out. Hey, if you want to check us out, you can come by Twitter or Facebook, we are /DrunkenUX, or Instagram, DrunkenUX Podcast, or Slack at /Drunken... Or, no, Slack is drunkenux.com/Slack. Or check us out if you have, 10 seconds and can run by iTunes and drop us a rating, or podchaser.com/drunkenux, drop us a rating or review if you've got a few seconds. Podchaser. That's all. We would appreciate it just because, hey, it helps people enjoy us, and we hope you enjoy us and all of those things. If you're tuning in, of course, there will be a new real-time overview coming up on this Monday. We are going through the holidays. We've got stuff planned. Don't worry about that. And then we are lining up season 2 with a few things. I've got some stuff in the works. I've got some ideas, some plans. If you hear some different stuff, that's all I'm going to say.
It's going to be pretty neat. We've got some cool ideas.
Folks, I've got only one other thing I can tell you, and it's the only thing I can leave you with at the end of the night after drinking a quarter of a bottle of Brick Lottie. I'm watching the Chiefs game. Motherfuckers, it is 30-30 going into the fourth quarter. I am dying over here. Do you know how hard it has been through this show to not scream into my microphone? That's all I can say.
I don't know.
All I know is keep your personas close, and please, for God's sake, keep your users closer. Bye-bye.